I'm wondering if, just to begin with, if anybody has a question. Sometimes it's good to ask before getting into trouble by saying anything. Ooh, very good. No one has any questions. Oh, okay.
I have a technical Buddhist question, if that's okay.
Sure.
So, I don't know how to phrase it. So, there's samadhi, right?
Samadhi?
Mm-hmm. I typically see it, samadhi as something that's kind of generated by effortless concentration or effortful concentration.
Yeah, I was gonna...
Yeah, sorry.
Yeah, okay.
All right. But anyone who's sitting for a while, as they're kind of walking around through their daily life, that something almost seems to kind of come upon them, not through their will. Would you still classify that as samadhi, or if not?
Could be, sure.
Yeah. Where it's not like, it's not something you're generating, it's something that kind of happens to you. Like even when you're not, when you're just kind of going through your ordinary mind.
Well, remember that an aspect of every moment of consciousness is samadhi. It's sometimes from the Abhidharma, it's translated as the necessary coherence for a thought or any reasonable mental activity to take place. So there's always some samadhi present. And cultivating in certain ways tends to invite that to grow. But as an experience of possibly ripening positive karma, one could find oneself in the midst of a so-called spontaneous samadhi. Yes, I would say.
Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Any other technical questions?
I think we could define samadhi.
Okay. Well, the verbal root dhi or dhyai means to reflect or consider or ponder. And the two verbal prefixes are kind of intensifiers. So sam tends to mean together. Ah tends to mean like very. So it's a very collected frame of mind, at least from the linguistic point of view. Okay. There's some debate whether, is that the same thing as dhyana, which actually comes from the same root? And again, there's debate about that.
There's the form and then formless dhyanas.
There are all kinds of dhyanas, but there are all kinds of samadhis. So how tightly you can nail this down is not so clear. But anyway, it's usually associated with meditative states. And one of the hallmarks of a certain experience of samadhi is that the mind can rest on a particular object, if you like, of concentration more or less indefinitely. There are also samadhis, they say, where all activity ceases completely. This is a particular type of samadhi. It's sometimes referred to as samapati, which is profound absorption, and is I sometimes say it's the psychophysical equivalent of absolute zero, in that there is no activity at all. And there's also a lot of debate around this. For instance, well, if that's the case, how do you ever get out of it? And people have been arguing about that for the last 2,000 years, so I have no particular answer to that question. When Buddha Dharma gets this technical, there tends to be quite a bit of disagreement. So bear that in mind. The likelihood is that anyone who cultivates, meditates even a little bit, has experienced samadhi, perhaps without noticing it or recognizing it. And maybe that's okay. Because if you decide you've got a handle on the hallmarks of samadhi and you're constantly trying to get at that, to make those hallmarks present, you're probably limiting your practice unnecessarily. So I would say let it happen. Let it be. this thing is horrible, but it's okay. We'll get used to it. It's all right. Sorry, I'm not supposed to complain. I forgot. Okay, anything else? So, Chan, or Zen, as we like to call it, was kind of like a big, refreshing wind that sort of blew through Buddha Dharma from somewhere off in the far west, for us anyway, off in the west, way off in the west. And any edifice that humans construct eventually acquires cobwebs. And, you know, the roof leaks a little bit, and places start looking a little shaky. So sometimes you have a wind come along and blow out the cobwebs and loosen the tiles on the roof so you can see which ones need repairing. Sometimes that's very helpful. So the Chinese who received Buddha Dharma from, again, the far west, and as you know, as the story is told, they kind of got everything sort of all at once, and people would show up with armloads of sutras, which had arisen in various eras of the Buddha Dharma and seemed to contradict each other and confuse the hell out of everybody for a while. It's like, well, this sutra says this, and this says something that seems like the opposite, and yet they both say, thus have I heard, at one time Buddha was staying such and such a place and said this. It's like, well, we don't get it. So, as you probably know, the Chinese said, well, it must have been that Buddha was teaching different things to different audiences with different capacities. And one really, really, really smart guy named Juri put just about everything he could get his hands on in a kind of a hierarchy based on when these teachings had been delivered and how determinative they were. As you may know, there are one of the main points of textual exegesis in Buddhism is a text considered in the Sanskrit nitartha, or is it neartha? Nitartha means kind of final absolute teaching. Neartha is something that needs interpreting for people. Okay. So, mostly, a lot of the sutras, the thus have I heard sutras, many of them are considered nitartha, that is, they are established teachings. Some of the shastras and commentaries, and certainly tantras and so forth, those need interpretation. Meanwhile, Juri says, well, it's pretty obvious if you read all this stuff, and I guess he had, which is pretty amazing right there, which means that a huge amount of stuff had been translated from Indian languages into Chinese. And he said, well, obviously at the very top is the Lotus Sutra. This is really pretty clear that Buddha began with the supreme teaching, and that's at the very top, and everything else comes later, right? And is was aimed at audiences with different capacities. And the what we think of as the earliest teachings, the ones that are recorded mostly, the only the surviving ones are in Pali. And they have counterparts in Chinese and Tibetan. And those were for the audience whose capacity was somewhat limited. And in fact, some of them had been scared out of the audience when Buddha was teaching the Lotus Sutra. So, in fact, supposedly, like 500 like arhat types, when they heard the Lotus Sutra, thought, "Oh man, this is too much. We're gone. We're out of here." So, when you encounter those teachings, says Juri, those are fine for maybe persons of capacity who, like, they aren't ready for that supreme teaching yet. So once this was kind of all organized, it was a pretty heavy-duty edifice there. It's kind of an amazing scholastic accomplishment. And then somewhere around in that same time, along comes Chan and Zen. And these were the people who had a tendency to say, what if the cleansing wind blew all of it away? Right? Just blew it all away. Where are we then? Where are we now? Naturally, there was some resistance to this. Some people didn't think that was a very good idea, good approach. Some people thought that, you really want a very measured, mapped out approach where all of the steps are clearly labeled and described. And by referring to whatever the map is, people can know where they are in their practice and where they have to go. And the Chan folks said, well, that's okay, but isn't all of that stuff empty anyway? Aren't those teachings all, to some degree, provisional and not ultimate? And when you look at that edifice of sutras and teachings that Juri had constructed, you kind of have to say, well, you know, I guess that's right. So Chan says, why don't we start at the top? Why don't we practice the way the Lotus Sutra says to practice, namely, you know what? There is only and ever one vehicle, and all beings are invited and ride along. And the practice is the practice of the Buddhas, not necessarily of, oh, we're just beginners and kind of novices, so we'll do, you know, this other simpler stuff. It's like, no, the wind is blowing that away now. And instead, the practice is the supreme practice right off the bat, right to begin with. And it's had various names, but we usually call it Zazen. It's a Japanese term. And sometimes we translate that as seated meditation. Sometimes I just call it practice. And that's the practice of sitting as Buddha sits. So you're kind of doing that right now. And it'd be really great if you don't make yourself a lot of trouble about that and start to think, why am I doing that? Maybe I'm not doing that. Maybe I just think I'm doing that. And then maybe someone will come along and say, well, you know what? Don't bother thinking that you're doing that or that you're not doing that. Let all of that stuff just flow on the way it does. And believe it or not, this leads us to tonight's story, which comes from the Blue Cliff Record, or a famous collections of Zen campfire tales, and deals with the great Tang Dynasty master, Yunlin. And one day, he was teaching his community, and he said, medicine and disease subdue each other. The whole world is medicine. What is yourself? That's it. That was his teaching. So, these were Buddhists, you know, and naturally, I'm sure the question arose, well, wait a minute, what's disease and what's medicine? And I'm sure we could answer that. Anybody want to say what's disease, for instance? If you're a Buddhist. Delusion, that's yes, okay. Mm-hmm. Okay, so we got delusion, we got greed, we got hatred, we have dukkha. Ignorance, I was going to say maybe the most catch-all expression is avidya, ignorance. So if that's, I feel like I'm strangling here. If that's, oh, sorry, I wasn't supposed to do that. If that is a disease, then what is medicine? Dharma. Okay. Dharma. Okay. If avidya is disease, then medicine is dharma. And here's Yunlan saying, medicine and disease subdue each other. That's a little funny, isn't it? Doesn't just medicine cure disease? Now, why would he... why would this Chan master present what it seems like a very simple teaching in this sort of funny way? Do you think? Yes?
Maybe it's because delusion isn't separate from enlightenment. Maybe it's enlightenment.
Maybe. Okay, so in that case, for instance, if medicine becomes the kind of an object of our attachment, then medicine can become poison. Yet he says the whole world is medicine. Means you can't look anywhere, you can't find anything that is not medicine. So how should we understand that?
Dharma gates are everywhere.
Yes, okay, good. Mm-hmm. So then maybe another way to ask the question is, where is the pivot? If medicine and disease are like the yin and the yang symbol, no, round and around, medicine subdues disease, disease comes around, subdues medicine. This is kind of like practice, actually. I don't know about you, but I don't think I've ever encountered a teaching that I didn't eventually get attached to. So where is the pivot? I am. Yes. That's one way to put it. Okay, so that therefore the pivot is where? Here. Yeah, let's say here. And then Yunman asks, what is yourself? This is that wind of Chan, just like blowing all of the pieces off the table. Medicine and disease subdue each other. Whole world is medicine. What is yourself? Just this. This being this or that or this. Anybody else? No wrong answers, remember. Beings. Okay. Mm-hmm. Sitting near, together right now, what is yourself? Was that medicine or disease?
Ball of wax.
Ball of wax? Is that the self?
Ball of wax.
Ball of wax. Right. All the objects of the senses. How about the senses themselves? The whole world is medicine. Yes, please.
So I was thinking everything is the pivot. The pivot is everything.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why I
mm-hmm. Yeah. As long as somehow this is included, sure. As long as it's not exactly out there. Yes.
It's the space between breath.
Space between breaths. And when we stop breathing?
We don't really stop. It's just the space between the next.
Well, I was with a gentleman the other day, and he definitely stopped breathing. So I was kind of wondering about that.
Okay.
Yeah. He did not. Not that I know of. Yeah. It was a remarkable experience, actually. And probably many of you have been with someone who died. And this was a little unusual. Just recently, you know, in California, it became legal for a physician to assist someone to die. And this was one of those instances. At the moment in Northern California, there are just two doctors who do that. And this was a very marvelous woman who came to the house. I'd been spending some time with the family. And the father had been ill with cancer for several years and had decided, I think this is enough. And so it was pretty intense. You know, he was obviously, you know, he was very, very thin and very weak. I've been in a lot of pain. And the doctor came. She was very, very calm, very professional, and also very warm. And I don't know if you know about the law, but the law indicates that the person who has elected this must be able to administer the medicine to him or herself. It cannot be given by someone else. So the way they decided to approach it, for the time being at least, is first the person is given a strong antiemetic, so the stomach will be very calm. Then this is all oral. You can't administer anything intravenously. Then a potent heart drug, which slowly, slowly slows the heart down, very, very gently. And then after half an hour, first the doctor attaches a monitor to the chest to be in touch with the cardiovascular system. And then as the heart has slowed down, then the last is administered a very, very powerful sedative. And the family gathered around and People told me, you know, we love you, Dad. And after about half an hour, it just sort of drifted away. And it was so peaceful and gentle. And as I say, he did stop breathing. So it's like if it's the space between breaths, or about when there's no apparent breath. So that's where, it's one of those places where, is this illness? Is this disease or medicine? How quickly a truth, a teaching, an experience can turn, you know? And that's okay. It's just like, okay, well, pay attention. You know? And if you see if that pivot is happening, then participate with your whole body and mind. Then the whole world can be medicine. There's this little story in the case where, this is from the great Avatamsaka Sutra, which I think Juri also put way at the top of the list, maybe second only to the Lotus Sutra. And in the section, the Gandavyuha section, where this young practitioner, Sudhana, is dispatched to go to, like, I forget, 50 some odd teachers and ask them about the teaching. In this particular instance, Manjushri says to Sudhana, would you go and find me some medicine, please? Bring me something medicinal. And Sudhana goes out there and looks around and around and around. And finally, he comes back and says, you know, all I could find was medicine. Everything was medicine. So Manjushri says, okay, bring me some of that. Sudhana goes and takes a blade of grass, says, here. And Manjushri takes a blade of grass and holds it up and says, this medicine can kill and restore to life. Whole world can do this. It's good if... Oh, yes, do you have a question?
Maybe then, if we don't realize that which we call disease is medicine, is where, you know, we just say, everything is medicine.
Mm-hmm. So we could get stuck. Yeah. We could get stuck there, right. Right. And then... You could say, well, then, kind of disease is overwhelming medicine. So then, maybe we'll have the great fortune to hear some teaching. And it's like, oh, we had this good. You probably all had that experience. You know, we encounter some great teaching. We feel like we've just been kind of let loose. And then maybe, after a little while, that medicine can turn poisonous. If we're not ready to let it go as the time dictates and needs. And when in Buddhism, there's this huge body of teaching. Oh my God, there's so much, you know. So for instance, there's just too much. I can't possibly deal with all this. So let me find out what's the really truest, best stuff, and that'll be my little package. It's like, you know, when you do that, it starts to die. And then it can turn toxic. So, did you have a question?
Yes, listening to your talk, it occurs to me that the labeling of disease and medicine can be a very arbitrary thing.
Yes.
And it really depends upon your perception of whatever.
And possibly itself a problem, that labeling?
I've heard that.
Possibly. So Master Yunnan was inviting all of us to attend to medicine or disease? Medicine or disease? Medicine is everywhere. So, who am I? Yes. Mm-hmm. Could you speak up a little bit?
I was poking around and thinking about will and intention.
Yes.
The difference between will and intention, where did they come from?
Uh-huh.
Because of the blame of rest.
Uh-huh.
Will to intention, to do this or that.
So,
where is that coming from?
Intention could be medicinal, and could it be sickness too? Yeah, because it's constantly doing this. And Chan was trying to point that out. It's like, how glorious the teaching is. But look, it can do funny things. A guy's setting, I think it was mostly guys, setting fire to each other's monasteries in Japan. That seems to be a little off. Or monks throwing each other's out of the windows in Korea. Happened during the 1950s, 40s maybe. Something's a little funny there. Something turned, and we forgot to notice. I'm sitting in Padmasana, and I was kind of thinking, that's one way to have a relatively short Dharma talk. Because I'm getting old enough now that I can't really sit this way very much anymore. So I thought, well, when I have to get out of my, ouch, Padmasana, then maybe that's when I'll say, okay, enough Dharma talk. But now I feel like, no, that was a little too slippery. So we will continue, but just for a little while. Oh, and I did write a little poem about this story, which I will share with you if you like. Okay. That's short. Let's see. Medicine is medicine. Old Shakyamuni is old Shakyamuni. Careful, child, they say. Don't eat what you find on the ground. Disease is disease. Legions of old monastics, nothing special. But when disaster strikes, who's got the remedy? 9 bows should suffice. But just in case, what is your self? The pharmacy opens to you. It's said that the collector of the Blue Cliff Records stories, Shredo, and a buddy of his, spent an entire night talking about medicine and disease subdue each other. He said it took them all night to exhaust that incredible teaching. They took no notes, so what they said, we don't know. But that's a good tip. Right now, medicine and disease are subduing each other. And that's us. round and round and round. Well, for us sentient beings, I don't know if we have much choice. It's just that's how it works. So the critical point is to pay attention, to watch and watch and watch. And when we're getting a little out of balance, you can usually sense it, actually, as long as we're open to that. Yes? The opioid epidemic. What once was medicine. Ooh, yeah. There it is.
I was just commenting that the opioid epidemic is medicine became disease.
Yeah, and maybe one of Zen's great gifts was to point out that even Buddha Dharma can do that. Malaysia, or southern Thailand, where Muslims are being persecuted by Buddhists. Like what? What? Yes.
You know, the other thing. A medicine for one disease will be a poison for a different disease.
Right.
So there's another piece there. It's knowing what is the disease to know what is the appropriate medicine.
Right.
So that gets another loop around that.
Right.
And that brings up the idea of an observer in that whole process.
Mm-hmm.
There's a doctor who...
Right.
Diagnoses and selects the correct medicine.
Yes.
So I think that's another aspect of that, and maybe that's a teacher.
Well,
in that process,
Yuan Wu, who commented on all of these stories of the Blue Cliff Record, points out that Buddha spent his whole life doing that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, for 49 years, in more than 100 assemblies, Buddha was doing just that. And again, they say, well, and this accounts for the tremendous breadth of the teaching. Some people heard one thing, and that was appropriate for them. Some people heard another. Sometimes Buddha taught something very different over here, seemingly a total other thing over here. It was the whole mystery of Tantra, and where did that come from? And some very smart people say, oh, that was there all along. You know, it's just, it was kind of underground. And it didn't surface until it was time. Until it was time for that medicine, you might say. Yes.
And maybe another thing might be, too, that check in with the self. Just because somebody said it or a doctor said it does not mean that it's the right thing for you,
mm-hmm.
or that it's the correct thing.
Right.
And I think when Dogen talks about look at myself, mm-hmm. and check it,
mm-hmm.
check what I'm teaching you. And I think that's another thing is to check, not just to totally trust blindly.
Right.
Without,
yes.
Is this right for me?
Yeah. I saw a short YouTube video of the Dalai Lama was commenting on the problems with Sogyal Rinpoche on the Rigpa community, and sometimes he gets kind of stern, and he was definitely stern. And he said, you know, you may think, my guru said, so it must be right. That is totally wrong. No, you must consider. You know, this is what he said. Does this make sense? Is this Dharma? Or is this just wrong? And if it is wrong, reject it completely. And he was very, very clear on that point. Yes.
I'm in a bit of a mischievous mood, so I'll share a joke that just occurred to me, but of course we have probably all heard of F equals MA.
Yes.
I'm thinking about the axis, and MA is another spelling for mother. And I'm suggesting that force might be the mother. I mean, if I ever start shouting and saying, this is the way it should be, well, there's conversely.
The feminine.
Yeah. Or, you know, that's how wrong I am. Mm. You know, if I similarly acid base, if I want to make an acid, I'm probably going to make a base at the same time. Mm-hmm. Or it's very similar to what goes up comes down. Or I drop something on the earth and the earth comes up to meet it, some fraction of a distance.
Mm-hmm. So the physical world has many lessons like that for us.
Thank you.
Oh, so there is.
Behind
you.
Yeah, I feel like there's almost no distinction between disease and medicine because, like, I feel like maybe this is where you were going with your joke, that sometimes disease can bring about great insight and realization, pain and suffering can. So yeah. I don't really know
disease,
where I was going with that.
Disease manifests as medicine.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah.
Yep.
It prescribes, yeah, itself.
Yeah, that's what Yunnan's talking about. You could throw it from there. No, maybe not. Thanks. Thanks, Marvin.
There's another story, and it quotes another story in the, well, this is, I think, the Blue in the Book of Serenity, but anyway, quoting the Avatamsaka Sutra. I was trying to remember it while you were talking, and then finally I got it. The fundamental affliction of ignorance is the immutable knowledge of all Buddhas.
Right.
Mm-hmm. The fundamental affliction of ignorance is the immutable knowledge of all the Buddhas.
Right. Right. Medicine or disease?
Right.
So it keeps occurring to me that while they nullify each other, they cause each other. I don't think we might have medicine unless we had disease.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. So Yunnan says subdue, but not forever. It's fun hanging out with you guys. Thanks for inviting me, sir. Yeah, you wanted to. Yeah, yeah.
Is there ever actually an end to the turning of the samsara? I mean, is that samadhi or nirvana? Or, I mean, does or is it all of it never ending, and we're trying to realize that it's never ending? I mean, is there a teaching about that?
Mostly Buddha said not to worry about that stuff. And the teaching was, especially for the Bodhisattva, Bodhisattva is ready to come back and back and back and back. And if there's some point where what we call samsara has no more beings in it who think they're in it, mm-hmm. that's fine. But we don't have to worry about that.
Yeah. Right?
So it's like, we shouldn't get too hung up on metaphysical questions. Like, is there an end to samsara? That may be one of the questions where Buddha said, don't worry about that. Just keep practicing.
Or like, you know, like an end to the perception of samsara. Like, or is samsara even real? Or is it just an illusion that there is this turning?
Well, you
know,
you could say it's an illusion, but it's a pretty good one.
Yes.
Most of us are, you know, it's pretty convincing. So we may also have moments where we seem to experience samsara as not moving at all. And some might say, well, that's a kind of samadhi. And then it would be good not to hang on to that, lest that turn into disease.
Just curious, thank you.
Uh-huh. Curiosity is good. Okay, well, I think I'm going to put my aching joints to rest now. Thank you all for your practice. May